So guys, the main attraction for Friday, the reason they're last is because everybody wants to see him, and that will keep you here through the end of the conference. So without further ado, I'll bring Jeff Arms and the state to the podium. Thanks, Jeff.
Thank you, Dion. Good morning, everyone. This session is the first time I've been able to say I can promise you before we're done, you'll get your money's worth out of this one. We have some new material to cover that hasn't been covered before, so bear with us. A lot of stuff's brand new right now. Get the hang of this new clicker. That's a picture of our new office building since we're going to move out of the Dix campus. The state built us a nice new high-rise. That's Tammy's office right there. Don, Luis, Rex down below there. Mine's down in the basement, but at least I got one. Don, look at the screen. I forgot to put our email addresses on there. No, we weren't hiding, no. We've been working on this presentation, had to make some changes right up to the very end as of about 7 o'clock last night because of the new material, but it'll be fine. First time in the history of me being at this series of meetings, I was here when Bill Warren announced his retirement, and now today we're announcing Steve Lewis's retirement as of May 1st. Steve's on his vacation this week, and he wanted this to be presented to your group, not so much as come as a shock, but to say that although it's coming up in May, and although our assistant chief retired the end of February, the faces you see at the table beside you and here are all going to be assuming different roles in the upcoming weeks, very likely. It's in the early stages. We all know each other. It won't be a fall-off-the-cliff transition, but we'll continue to work together. Stay tuned on that as it unfolds. Same level of concern about the facilities we have. There will be no abrupt changes, but Steve wanted to express his appreciation to NCHEA for a long-standing relationship. He knows most of the members, and it's a source of pride to have that relationship. We hope to continue that, Dion, going forward. In the audience with us, we have some staff members. Don's going to be up here presenting with me shortly. Tony McQuage, a reviewing engineer. Tammy Sylvester, an engineering supervisor. Fran Pedrigi, architectural supervisor. Luis Padilla, and Rex Williams. Did I leave anyone out? Keith here? Okay. This slide represents new material, and it's the first time ever at any presentation we've talked about any of this. Hate to have to do it, but it's the world today. I'm going to have to take a few minutes and discuss some new things with you. The coronavirus, everyone knows about and is learning about, it's uncharted territory, and it's unfolding. What changes will result in the way we do our business, your business? We're working through that. Will any of the rules, by the way, I hear nobody coughing, that's a good sign. Having said that, I'll probably start coughing now. Will any rules change? Yes, some. And that's unfolding as we are working day by day. Since last Saturday, Sunday, day and night through the week, a couple of changes have occurred. One was sent out to all hospital CEOs and presidents last night at 4 o'clock. The second one arrived at my computer at 10 o'clock last night. And I will give you an overview of those things as best I can. And since it's extremely new, I'm holding in my hand one of the waivers for a particular hospital licensure rule that will allow extra space to be created for COVID-19 patients, or that's what it was designed for. I'll speak to that in a moment. Will there be an accumulated use of temporary structures for one purpose or another to serve this population that may need to be tested for coronavirus? Yes, on a limited basis. I'll speak to that as best I can this morning. When we leave here today, after we collect all the questions and chat with you, I'll go back to the Raleigh office and be immersed in this more and in the life safety code, which hinges on one of these waivers, so that when the questions and phone calls start piling in, we'll have a little bit better ammunition to speak case by case to you about them. In our office, we're changing, because of the governor's declaration of an emergency, some of our approaches to meetings. We won't have as many of them face-to-face. We'll do more teleconferencing. Submit questions and drawings if you would ordinarily want to come in for a conference. Submit them to us. Maybe even courier a set of drawings. We may be able to speak to you by electronic means or simply on a conference call. It's minute by minute how we'll revise our activities. We're not going to shun any of our business activity, but we do have to modulate how we have contact with the general public. Why? We are in all facilities. We have 5 groups of different types of surveyors, and they're all over the state in all kinds of facilities. Will we continue to do inspections? As far as we know, yes. We haven't had any change in our schedule for inspections. However, the methodology of our inspections is evolving. Some of you know we've been experimenting with doing some FaceTime inspections for certain systems where you can walk around with a phone. We can ask you to show us this or that. We're trying those things. Some projects we'll approve by documentation if they're straightforward. We're doing that on a limited basis now. The documents would have to be pretty good, and it would not be for an OR or for an ICR type project where there were extreme life safety circumstances. Unless we get orders that we can't go out and do inspections for now, they're still on the books. It's day by day, case by case. Tammy, do you have anything that you would want to add about the inspection or any of these points before I talk about the waivers?
The only thing I will say is, you know, a lot of inspections we come, there's like 30, 40 people for like 2 of us. If you could limit the number of people, like we want all trades there, but we don't need 5 people from the trade if we got the people who really know the system. That way it'll cut down on having so many people on an inspection to help mitigate the risk of maybe catching something. But other than that, I think that's it.
A waiver has been issued to, let me read you the sentence for the one that I have a printout for. This went out yesterday afternoon. At this time, DHSR will waive the limitations found in Hospital Licensure Rule 0.3111. For example, the limitation on increasing beds to 10% above the license capacity when your census exceeds 90%. The limitation on utilizing observation beds only for overflow, and the limitation for that being used for a period of not greater than 60 consecutive days. Waive these things to the extent necessary to allow a hospital to provide temporary services to adequately care for patients that may be stricken by COVID-19 based on the following parameters. And it goes on for equivalent of about a page to give the particulars. What it's essentially saying is, if you have observation beds, call us, let us know what your plan, what your need is. It is case by case. You do have to not just call, I said that wrong, has to be presented in writing from hospital administration to explain the planned increase in bed capacity that is necessary for public health and safety in the geographic area served. The physical facilities to be used have to be ensure that they're adequate to safeguard the health and safety of patients, and it has to be operated in conformance with CMS requirements for participation and application of any temporary CMS rules for inpatient care. So all hinges around inpatient service. You also have to have in writing a physical description of the space, the location of the space you want to use, how it's equipped, and we have to take and look to make sure that the requirements of the life safety code continue to be met. Whether the space is in your hospital, on your hospital campus, or in the community. There's only so many questions about that I can answer today because it's brand new, but it's not a free-for-all. It's not a do what you want to do. This thing was very carefully written over a period of several days to make sure that life safety requirements have to be met no matter what you do. It means you can't stack gurneys in the corridor once the observation beds are full. If a hospital owns an AMSURG that you can have some space in that is equipped to meet the life safety code, it's fair game if you want to write that up and let us take a look at it. I understand there may be some additional ideas that we'll talk to some of you about today after this is over that might be viable. The ideas have to be evaluated by our office and by licensure and certification for viability. There are options available to you as and if the number of virus cases increase. In other words, that one says we're waiving the 10%. Temporary structures. Last night at 10 o'clock, I got notification that the second waiver that we've been working on for a week is the use, I don't have this one printed out, so I'll try to paraphrase it, the potential use for temporary structures for a very limited amount of hospital function, such as an ED waiting room, triage, and space to conduct the test. As people present to hospitals and say, I think I have the symptoms, I need the test, they walk into the ED, EMTALA says you can't turn them away till they're evaluated, stabilized, or determine a course of action or where you go next. But if there is an overflow of these patients, you can't really have public safety if the waiting room has now got a whole big crowd in there. Some of them are presenting virus-like symptoms. Until there is a national waiver of portions of the EMTALA requirements, for now what the state is going to do is allow, sort of like what you see, temporary structures that can be reasonably upfit, even though the FGI rule requirements for waiting rooms, ED waiting rooms, and triage areas, and a certain amount of exam rooms will be waived. We will have some guidelines that we've been working on for a week to send to you when you call and say, we need to do this. We will work with you case by case to see what you want to do, where you can put it, what your structure is like, and how you can meet as many of the suggestions as we have to make sure that you don't take a nosedive in essential patient and community safety. That's what I'll be working on when I get back to Raleigh. That one's brand new. That one is probably going to be useful to you. The EMS, state EMS, has a certain amount of assets like this available, I think maybe up to 100. And several years ago, Don and I worked with EMS on the mobile disaster hospital, looking at the components of it to try to determine how close to actual hospital licensure rules could any of these assets become. It's very difficult to make a tent-like structure equal or equivalent to the service nature of the hospital rules. So that's why the waiver is very limited. But we did put a lot of thought into it, and we will discuss with you case by case the bullet points. There's about 30 or 40 of them. can't get anybody hurt crossing the parking lot if you install a generator, portable generator. Will you have HEPA filtration if you've got 40 people inside a tent that are all presenting symptoms? It makes a lot of sense. Work with us on it. This one is unfolding. At the end of this session, we will stand here and talk to you about whatever we can answer to the limits of the information we have. No matter what happens, no matter what waivers are issued for an undetermined period of time, the slide on the left speaks to our mission statement. We've shown this slide before. We won't really be able to waive too much of providing a safe, healthy, and suitable environment for anybody using the facilities. That one doesn't get waived. You feel free at any time to call our help desk number, 3893. For now, the physical plant questions, that all of them are going to come to construction section. Some of them will come to Azzy Connolly's group and licensure and certification as well. But for the use of the fabric structures or alternate locations, you'll contact construction section, and we'll work with those things together. I haven't received any calls yet, but I haven't seen my voicemail yet either. All right. We debated on whether to cut off the presentation before doing the additional educational items, but it's kind of important that we run through this part as well. For the last 3 years, we've been talking more and more about the implementation and the state's adoption of FGI guidelines. It was done in 2018, January 1st. That was for hospitals, the blue book, this one. You've seen this before. Everybody's using it now. Pretty much everybody in this room is familiar with it. As of July 1st, 2020, the state will formally finish its adoption of this book for outpatient facilities. And we'll show you in a minute how to use this book, how to decide whether you use this book or this book for certain projects. We've got several examples that we'll show. FGI also publishes a third book, which is called For Residential Facilities, which means nursing homes, assisted living, hospice, and a couple other of residential in nature facilities. North Carolina hasn't adopted that one and may not. It's not in the foreseeable future, although the book is written by the same people that create the guidelines for the first two books, and it's published on every fourth year. So the outpatient guidelines have been adopted. The legislation was passed amending the existing 10A NCAC 13C rules for ambulatory surgery centers, licensure rules for AMB surgeries. But only certain portions of this book were adopted. You can see at the bottom of the screen the different parts and chapters to take the place of the existing ambulatory surgery licensure rules. Part one, just like it is in the hospital book, it's got the glossary, tells you how to use the functional program requirement, how to create and submit that. Part two, chapter 2.1, are the common elements for outpatient facilities. 2.2 are the specific requirements for certain types and portions of outpatient facilities. 2.3 is not used, imaging. The next portion that was formally adopted was the 2.7 chapter for outpatient surgery facilities, and a distinct chapter now, which is something different for the first time, 2.9, for endo facilities. Why not adopt the entire book? The legislation wrapped around this was designed to make it easier and more comprehensive to design outpatient surgery facilities and endoscopy facilities. Where previously we only had 13C rules for AMSURG, there was this cloaked within the AMSURG rules a set of watered down rules for endoscopy facilities that you had to call in and ask, do we really need to have full-blown ORs for these endo procedure rooms? And we'd work through you on a rule-by-rule basis. This takes the mystery out of it. There's a chapter for each. No. Yep. Mm-hmm. Who said that? So I can look right at you. 2.1, 2.2, 7, and 9. One of the reasons why the book was adopted is these four items. FGI is a recognized national standard, used to be AIA guidelines. It's grown in its thoroughness from that from quite a number of years ago. Lucian, you know all about AIA guidelines from many years back, so this is a modern adaptation of that. It's the evolution of it. It's kept current. The people that write these rules work on them throughout the four-year cycle, and in the fourth year, the new book is published. Designers throughout the nation are already using these guidelines to design quality facilities. It's not anything new to designers throughout the nation. And as we said, there's no more watered-down rules, no more mystery. It's all in white-page text. So if the effective date of the adoption of the rules is July 1st, can we go ahead and use the orange book now? Yep. And there's two ways you can go about it. One, if you're designing a project prior to the effective date of July 1st, owners may elect to use this book for their AMSURG or endo facilities. Or you can continue using the existing 13C rules. You just can't pick some from each source and pour into the same project. Here's the second way you can use the outpatient guidelines. You remember the last couple of sessions, we mentioned a thing called FGI has an errata page. It's available through their website. It's not in the book. It's something that's updated. I'll show you a picture of it in just a minute. FGI came out with an errata that they made on their own. It's not a North Carolina item, but it applies to the use of the facility, the use of the guidelines for those facilities. And it was done in April, I believe I'm seeing that right, April 13th. The errata for outpatient services in a hospital requires you to now use, you got a hospital with an outpatient service in it, and we'll show you a picture of it in a minute. Use this book for it to fall under those guidelines. North Carolina determined on its own in italics at the bottom of the screen whether or not your distinct outpatient service is located inside the hospital or outside the hospital. For whatever outpatient services are done under the hospital's license or Medicare provider number, use the orange book. Before we show you the half dozen examples we have, be familiar with these buzzwords, which pretty much everybody is. We will mention quite a bit the phrase hospital-based service. That is a healthcare service that's operated under the hospital's license and provider number. We just spoke about errata. I'll show that to you in the next slide. And the bottom thing we started talking about here on this stage in 2009, there was a piece of North Carolina legislation that is the House Bill 1297 that differentiates between a business occupancy and a hospital, whether and it indicates whether or not to submit a project to us for review, essentially, or if you just design certain types of MOBs and go on about your business. I'll show you an example of it. This is the page that features the actual errata statement that the FGI came out with. It says, outpatient projects located in hospitals shall meet the requirements of the outpatient guidelines. That appears when you look at the errata sheet for the hospital book. Our interpretation was, even if the outpatient service is not in the hospital, use the orange book anyway. If it's across the street, anything under the auspices of the hospital's license and Medicare provider number. The last thing is the infamous House bill. This is the operative text of it in blue at the top. Simply defines that a hospital is any facility which has organized medical staff, provides health care, has physicians. That's typical definition of a hospital. It goes on to say in the center section in gold, the term does not include any outpatient department, including a portion of a hospital operated as an outpatient department, whether it's on or off the hospital's campus, that's operated under the hospital's license or provider number, and is a business occupancy according to the definition by the Life Safety Code. The last section further amplifies, and this is the important part, if the business occupancy outpatient location is within 30 feet of the hospital, unless it's classified as ambulatory health care occupancy or health care, you don't need to submit that project to us for review. Show you examples now. Example number one, scenario one. You have a hospital that has in the right-hand corner, let's say it has a bunch of infusion bays in the corner of the hospital. If you look at the criteria section, this is a hospital-based service. The outpatient function is owned and operated by the hospital. It's outpatient only because they chose to make this a business occupancy. In this case, they just have a rated separation between the occupancies. Which rules they use? The design of the outpatient center, hospital rules or outpatient guidelines. Through the errata, you got a distinct outpatient service in the hospital, so you use that book. That's the simple example. Next example, you got a hospital. They have a hospital-owned MOB. It is a business occupancy. You see down below the little MOB. Let me see if I can use this. No more than three patients are rendered incapable of self-evacuation in that MOB. You can see it's 29 feet from the hospital, so it's a little closer than 30. What do you do with it? You use the hospital guidelines errata note. You use the North Carolina interpretation that says this outpatient facility is owned by the hospital, but it's across the street. You'll use the orange book to design the facility, and you'll have to submit it to our office for review, even though it's a business occupancy, because of its close proximity to the hospital and what the House bill said. Let's try one that's a little more ticklish. Hospital has a three-story MOB on the same campus of the hospital, but this time it's further away, 750 feet. It's owned, operated by the hospital. Look closely at what's on each floor to see that it is still a business occupancy. On the top floor are infusion bays, middle floor infusion bays. Those are considered to not render patients incapable of self-evacuation. On the ground floor, they have some imaging and diagnostic equipment, a LINAC, a CT, and an MRI. Technically, if they're not using anesthesia in this building, you're technically exempt from review by the House bill because you're still a business occupancy with no more than three rendered incapable of self-evacuation. Look again. Same scenario, hospital, same MOB, 750 feet separation. It's owned by the hospital. It's three-story. What kind of occupancy would that MOB be? Save time. It's no longer business occupancy because look at the ground floor. You've got two LINACs, a CT, and an MRI. And in this MOB, the CT might be a CT sim or a CT, but they have stipulated in the functional program that you use modeling and masks. So that means even on the CT, the patient, some patients are actually tied to the table, so you don't move, so you get a good scan. Two, Linacs. One CT, one MRI. That's four patients that are considered rendered incapable of self-evacuation. They're using anesthesia to some degree for some of these patients, similar to an endo patient gets. You got to recover from it for a little while. So you have more than four people now rendered incapable of self-evacuation. After your MRI is done, if you are a patient that needs to be slightly sedated and it takes you 15 or 20 minutes to wake up, you're still considered incapable of self-evacuating. So what does that mean for this building? It's got to be designed for ambulatory health care, not business. Automatically, per the House bill, we have to review that one. Through the hospital, which owns this MOB, through the FGI errata statement, what do you use to design that building with? Hospital rules or outpatient rules? Outpatient book. Through the errata in FGI guidelines for a hospital. It's owned, the MOB is owned by the hospital, but it's an outpatient-only facility. Inpatients don't go in that MOB. Only got a couple more examples here. This is a freestanding building where some doctors got together. They got a CON to operate three endos. It's not owned or operated by a hospital. It's just down the road by itself, operating as the doctor's endoscopy center. They have three endos. What would you use to design that? You'd have to use FGI outpatient, chapter 2.9, like Lucian was talking about a minute ago. This type of building now has the chapter dedicated to endo in here, not the mysterious what do we use to, what kind of systems do we put in an endoscopy center, because we can't tell clearly from the old 13C AMSURG rules. We have to review it. We just talked about anesthesia incidental to endoscopy. Even though you got three procedure rooms, you got three people maybe recovering from what little anesthesia they may give you, or a lot. Even after they take you out of an endo, chances are somebody's still recovering while they get the room ready for the next endo patient. So at one time, you may easily have more than three. It would have to be designed for ambulatory health care. From another state, some doctors or an AMSURG company gets a CON for four ORs, not owned or operated by a hospital. We have a lot of these in the state. What do you do with it? You have to use chapter 2.7 for surgery in this book. Previously, you'd have used the old 13C rules. Don, can you come up here and help me with Bob's part? If Bob Strother were here today, I'd be glad to talk to any about any of the FGI guidelines, hospital or inpatient. We're going to transition to Don's part of the program, and then we'll answer your questions. But if Bob Strother were here today, we are speaking to a topic that he gets a lot of questions about, and it's unobstructed means of egress. Let's say we're talking about hospitals for this part of the presentation. I'll do the buzzwords, and then I'll switch with you. There are a few phrases that will make sense to you when we talk about the requirements for not blocking corridors according to 101 in hospitals or healthcare facilities. One is pretty much everybody's familiar with the three components of the means of egress. It's a continuous and unobstructed way of travel from any point in a building all the way to the public way, and that's from the definition in 101. Three components: exit access, the exit, and the exit discharge. Another buzzword that's useful for the rest of the presentation is unobstructed travel. You'll find a discussion of that in 7.1.10.1. That means don't impede. It literally says No type of barrier can impede free and full instant use of the means of egress. The authority having jurisdiction for through 101 and for the purposes of this conversation is our office, and it justifies the slides that we're about to present. You want to do this one or me?
It don't matter to me. I guess if I'm going to do Bob's part, I got to tell some kind of stupid joke, right? Is that the way it works? So,
no.
Most of you know me. I had a knee reconstruction, and so I wear a prosthetic knee brace when I'm on inspections. Well, this week, of course, I know there's a shortage on toilet paper, so I got kind of concerned, and I called my orthopedic guy, and I said, just want to make sure my brace is about to get wore out. Are there going to be more on the shelves? And he said, you know, it's funny you asked that. He said, there's a real problem going on right now. There is a shortage of the prosthetic braces. How many of you knew that? None of you. Y'all should know, though. What they've had is there's been a tremendous increase in funny bone and bruised elbows and tennis elbow injuries. Y'all been walking around like this for a week. You know what I'm talking about. Okay. All right. Well, was that better or worse than Bob's? I don't know. Okay.
Don't answer that.
Don't answer. Means of egress. We all know means of egress have to be main, shall be continuously maintained. Almost every time we go on site as a licensure into these facilities that are under construction, we find means of egress that are partially choked down or fully choked down. Again, you've got your exit access corridors got to be maintained free. You've got your stairways got to be maintained free. You can't put a lock on the stairwell door. You've got to maintain exit out of a room. And actually, I didn't know this slide was here, but I've got a good picture of exit access out of a room here a little bit later. In a hospital, can a portion of the corridor be partitioned off to allow existing work and or new construction? We've already kind of said no. CMS facilities have to be maintained. Again, if you're a licensed facility, you also have to maintain to compliance with licensure rules, even if you're not a CMS certified facility.
These questions that Bob put on these slides are questions he asked CMS. The bottom half of the slide are the answers from CMS.
And I know I'd heard that we got something back from CMS, but I didn't know that got confirmed. So, again, a lot of people were saying other states, and there was some other people that were doing some presentations in other states that were saying, yeah, this state allows it, that state allows it, and that's what Bob went to CMS, to the federal group in Atlanta and out of,
Baltimore,
to verify that. If you're able to use the temporary partitions, what can they be made of? Again, you can use gypsum board, but if you're using a cloth material, it's got to meet 241. So, again, it's got to be non-combustible construction. Again, some of you in the past have had the temporary shelters coming out to some of your mobile units. And again, as long as it's all non-combustible material, say steel construction, if your tarp is non-combustible, materials complying with the codes, most of those are okay, but run those by our office to make sure you got the right one being used. Rare cases. If you've got one of these four-way intersections and you're trying to replace the tile or the carpet in that four-way intersection, it's almost impossible to do. Now, I can tell you 3 years ago, the answer you'd hear from our office is, if you have this situation, then you take this patient room's in the corner, you use the door there, you cut another door there, and that's how you get around that intersection while you fix it.
And you can still do that.
But we will work with you on a case-by-case basis. So if you get the approval for what kind of systems you put in place to do for one situation, that's for that one situation only. The next time you have to do it, a different quarter, a different building, you can't just say we did this before and it's okay. Yes. A prayer, the prayer you have is about, if we go in and find it, your prayer lasts about 2.5 hours because that's how far away the closest CMS guy is. How's that? Is that a good prayer? Quarter obstruction question. What type of interim measures will CMS allow? Guess what the answer is. CMS requires, there is no designated interim life safety measures that you can just do to avoid this thing. So again, if you have a project or you have a situation where you're having to deal with this, submit it to us. Again, you need to make sure you've gone through all avenues and there's no other way around it. And then we'll take a look and work with you as we can. Everybody with us so far? Do we see any partial blockages here? I think we've seen this picture here. Here's one with a clothes rack and actually an exit sign with door with tape on it there. Another blocked one. And here's an example of a smoke detector that's in the middle of a smoke barrier. So it's not a smoke barrier, but a partition wall. So again, even if you have an area that you're allowed, like if you're inside a suite, you're allowed to put up a partition wall because you don't have to maintain those quarters inside the suite. You can't separate the middle of that corridor or hall or pathway and leave the smoke head and the sprinkler on one side and have no protection on the other side. So again, you need to submit those plans to us if you're going to do something like that. Now, exits must be maintained full quarter width at all times. Oops. Back. Okay, so let me do my normal disclaimer on these next slides. The names are removed to protect the guilty because, you know, so if you see one of your slides, don't raise your hand and say, yeah, I remember that one. Nobody's going to know whose slides these are, okay? Yeah. Okay. So again, Dion submitted most of these. No, I'm just kidding.
No, I didn't submit them. You took them.
Okay. So, again, these are items we should not see on a final inspection. Again, I know some of you are prior military in here, but I was in the Navy, and I treat it just like when I was a facility manager. Doesn't matter who's doing the project in my facility. I'm the one that inherits it when it's done. So if the contractor gets by and I kind of close my eyes and let the state come in and approve the project a year from then, now I'm paying to fix it, and I'm the facility guy. Just like on a ship, you come out of the shipyard, if it's not right, you get out at sea, there is no repair shop. You're the one that becomes fixing it. So who's minding the store? You know, it's amazing that we can go in and we can find an electrical panel above the sink. I mean, at least they didn't have a receptacle beside it without a GFI protection. Gaskets and final filters in HVAC systems. I can't understand why we're still finding this. I mean, we go in there and there's no gaskets on the final filters. The problem, more than just not having the gaskets on them, to me, when I see a final inspection like that, I say your air balance report is no good because you did your air balance without any filters in the system. So you think your values are going to change? Of course they're going to change. Here's a step stool, I guess, to be able to see the gauges there. And there's a service receptacle. Now, this picture doesn't do this justice, so I did get another one just to show that 7'2" is about what you need to be to reach that. Here's one that was repaired, and that's 1 foot, 2 foot, 3 foot, 4 foot, 5 foot, 6 foot, 7 foot. It was an easy fix. All you had to do was bring a receptacle down here where people would reach it. But this was on a roof. This was a roof that we had to climb a ladder. I guess it's probably about 20 feet up the outside. And they said, well, you know, we can reach it. I'm tall enough. I said, I'll tell you what, I'll let you leave the receptacle where it is. But that means you're going to have to position a ladder on this roof because there's no way anybody's going to carry a ladder up that 20-foot outside ladder to get up to that roof to get to that unit, and they decided it was easier to do that. Same thing with the generator. It's really easy to put a platform there if you know you got to do one. This one, I'll tell you, this was a cloth stuffed in a sanitary drain that I saw on the final inspection. So I kind of questioned it, and they said, yeah, we'll go ahead and fix it. So we said we'd take docs on the fix at first. Here was the fix. Now, they found a new use for fire stopping. I always say you can't make this up, and you really can't. So then they said, well, that line's not being used right now. Well, the line still goes somewhere, and 5 years from now, somebody's going to tie into it. So again, who's minding the store and who's going to accept the problem down the road? Here's one. This is on a final inspection. I mean, who looked at that before we got there? Now we're going to go to my favorite one. I did show this to two engineers here, and they said, no way is that real. Well, here's a way somebody repaired a plumbing repair, right? Again, we might have to X that out here. That's not a plumbing repair. Look at that. Oh, my God. I'm glad other people are saying that. You can't make this up. This is a final inspection in between two LDRs, a storage room. Now, I could say maybe nobody noticed this. However, the storage room is 1 hour rated, and there's four dampers in that room. So who tested those dampers and didn't know that line was like that? I apologize that you can't hear the sound of that. When I popped out the ceiling tile, I was like, man, you guys got one heck of an air leak. I'd like to see your balance report. But by the time I got my head above there, I said, I don't need to see your balance report, but you're probably using a lot of oxygen somewhere. That's kind of scary, ain't it? I know we talk about these level one generators have to have, if you got operable louvers, they got to be spring open, motor to close. Oops. On that, it was just trying to show those are weighted louvers. So again, if you've got a level one generator, you can't use self-closing louvers. Everybody knows that, right? Anybody in here doesn't know that? Anybody not want to answer the question? Come on, everybody. Okay. Not on the slides, but there's three other things on level one generators. There's a 40-degree temperature requirement. So if you don't have weighted louvers and you're not using operable louvers that are spring motor to open, and you use fixed louvers, maintaining 40 degrees in that enclosure, you got to have a heater in there. Don't go to Walmart and buy a heater and set it inside the enclosure. Okay, if you look at the manufacturer, they say optional heater. Now, I went through this with a designer and an owner, and they said, look, it says the heater's optional. I said, yeah, the heater's optional because if you're a level two, it's not a problem. If you're a level one, the heater's no longer optional. But it says it's optional. When is the best time to fix something? Well, here's the final inspection. I guess they were trying to make a complete contact between the metal on the top and the metal on the bottom. But we got 2 points of dissimilar metals touching in that one. Here was some wires that were run, and they decided to just smack a big hole instead of doing two penetrations. And I'm not sure, but fire caulking's not supposed to be stretched 3 inches across a hole. And this is just a picture of the oxygen line, just in case you forgot how crazy that one was. Oops. When is the best time to fix something? This is a rated wall with no labels. Well, I guess it's not a rated wall, so that's why they didn't put the They took the labels down because they were like, oh no, they're gonna see these holes. We better remove the labels. That's what it was. Now it makes sense. I wish I would have thought about that. How many of you ever been inspected by me? What is the thing I always cite? Sprinkler control valve labels, right? In the old code, it was section 7.4.3. In the new code, it's section 18.2.2.1, I believe. Sprinkler control valves are to be labeled to indicate the area or portion of building served. It's been in the code for 20 years. It's been in the code for, actually, it's been in there, I don't know how old I am, but since the late 80s. We should never find a control valve that's not labeled when we come on inspection. We did a whole section on sprinkler control valves, and where's Brett? Brett still here? He just did a session on sprinkler systems, and he talked about how much water leaks into your building in between when you get to the valve and close it. Well, if you got four valves side by side and you close the three that are not feeding the leak first, then that's that much water that flowed because you didn't know which one was which. Just provide the label like what's required. Here's another one that, you know, no closer than 3 feet between smoke heads and supply, exhaust, or return registers. Now, that's not the only requirement. If the airflow interferes with operation of that device, it could have to be 5 feet away. It depends on how much air you got coming and if it's traversing across the ceiling. But this and this... Well, actually, this either. I mean, we shouldn't see that stuff when we come out for a final. I understand everybody's working on how to keep their costs down and not paying somebody to do any preliminary inspections, but if they're not going to do it, maybe the facility managers, now I'm talking to the people that aren't here, so that's not really doing me any good either. So, mobile unit maintenance records. How many of you realize that we're on FGI now, and FGI says that you've got to maintain maintenance records for your mobile units? Testing must be done every mobile unit at relocation and setup. If you got one sitting on your site, and you pull it out to pull in the litho, and then you pull the litho out to pull in the CT for the next 2 days, and then you pull the CT out, it's an awful lot of inspections, but that's what it requires. Grounding system, the power system, exit lighting, your connections to your fire alarm, testing your nurse call, your staff assist, and your telephone to your direct host. We will have this presentation on the website. I'll send it to Dion and Mike as soon as we're done here. Our presentations usually get finished up like in the hotel the night before. So, Jeff, are you done yet? Are you done yet? Give me 10 more minutes. You know how long 10 minutes is with this guy? It's about 4.5 hours.
Yes, thank you.
Locking systems. In the past 2 weeks, I've gone into three buildings and found three non-compliant locking systems that we weren't even there to inspect. For some reason, when I walk in, I just notice stuff. No emergency light at locked door controls. The 2018 code specifically cleared that one up and says you've got to have an emergency light at the locked door. So that's got to be the closest life safety light to that door. Used to be just said you had to have emergency lighting. Now it says emergency light at the locked door. Not releasing on fire alarm. What do you think happens when your lock system doesn't release on fire alarm when we're there? Well, I know you said immediate jeopardy. I'm not allowed to say that. What I do is I call Jeff and I say, Jeff, here's what I got. This is what I'm going to do. And hopefully we don't have to call Bob's crew. But we are not allowed to declare that. But again, if you don't either turn it off or make it work right while we're there before we leave the building, then we call CMS, and they just happen to be close within about 2.5 hours, and they'll come out and help you out. Remote release, not releasing all the doors in the path of egress. Again, we find you got two nurses stationed. This one releases the center door and that stairwell, and this one releases the center door and no stairwell, and that one over there releases just a stairwell door. If you got to pass through two or three or four doors, the release device has got to release all doors in that path of egress. The system has to be one electrical system. Electrical diagram and the system component location map's got to be posted at the fire alarm panel. Code says under glass. Now, I'm not saying that we say if you don't have a piece of glass there, we got a problem with it. Or I didn't just say that. But again, that's what the code says. If you've got it at the fire alarm panel, we're okay with it. But I guarantee you at least 20% of you can go back to your facilities and you'll find you won't have that there. Local release has to be of the on-off type switch. Can't be momentary. Can't be an air pressure that drops out in 20 or 30 seconds. Can't be the push to exit button, which you would use for access control. If it's special locking, you can't use that push to exit green button for access control. That only holds it for 30 seconds. Testing requirements. They got to be approved prior to installation. Got to be tested after installation, prior to initial use, periodically thereafter. DHSR must complete inspection of your locking systems to verify compliance before you put them into use. Why is that? I've got one facility out there that I went out and inspected their completed locking system, I think it was about 3.5 weeks ago, and they haven't called me to tell me that they're ready yet. Now, this is one that actually locked down a door that was never approved, we determined, because it wasn't hooked to any releases and it was just an extra one that was added in their system along the way. It wasn't part of the project and wasn't part of any work before. Somebody just decided they want to lock somewhere over the past 3 years in a building. Oops. This amazes me too. So I cannot believe, and again, I mean, you all tell me if you see an exit sign somewhere in this. I mean, there's a cross corridor doors there, there's cross corridor doors there, and there's the end of a hall down there. Here's going the other direction. And I looked and looked, and I was like, I can't see any exit signs. It's been like this for 20 years. I can't explain that one. It's not a certified facility, though. I did find that out. So, now what we were talking about, and I said we'll show you a little bit later. I did have to blue out. I wouldn't say black out, but I blew them out. The names of the construction company advertising that they're locking this door here. So once you go into room 254. The construction area is all on the other side of that. And I said, so if they're in there, how do they get out of there? Oh, they come out this way. I said, so while they're in there, and an Alzheimer's patient walks up and sticks a pencil in that latch there, and then somebody else sets a building on fire, then how do they get out? I guess the only real answer is once the door burns out of the way, then you can come out of the room. But you can't block an exit. That's an exit path for the construction worker if they got to come out this way. Required life safety lighting cannot be connected to timers and must not be switched. Everybody knows that, right? Anybody that didn't know that? Everybody knows that, right? Everybody know it? Anybody still awake? Yeah. Oh, yeah. Huh? Did you see? Okay. So there's been a lot of this. Oh, go ahead. On a path of egress on the exterior of the building. On a required path of egress to the public way. Cannot be on a timer. It must not be switched. You can have them on a photo cell, but not on a timer and not on a switch. Nope, not per the definitions in 101, in or the building code. It specifically says that. Now, I am going to talk about switches to get to what you're talking about, because a lot of people are all hung up on this UL 924 switch thing. I don't know, and I kept asking people why they're wanting to use it, but what I'm hearing is the UL924, you can use it on dimmers, and so you can dim down your life safety lighting, and then if you lose power, it brings the lights to full power. It's kind of makes sense in theory, but if I was still a facility director, it means I'm bringing normal power to the light, I'm bringing life safety power to the light, and then I'm paying for a switch to interconnect it just so I can dim it down. Why don't you just have life safety lights at the minimum lighting level and then dim all your other lights without paying for that extra 924? And if anybody has the answer to that, let me know on the side afterwards. I mean, don't make me look stupid right now, or you can make me look stupid. I don't care. It'll work. So, compliant life safety lighting. This is real in a facility. This is what we're talking about. This one here created, these are timers that they only turn them off at nighttime. Now, that made good sense. So we're going to turn off all our life safety lighting at nighttime while the residents are in the bed asleep. This one over here, the switch is right on the wall here. You flip it. That light's really out. It's the light from here is actually shining up to hit that. Okay, 101, 7.8, shall be continuous during conditions of occupancy unless provided in 78122. And then 7812 says the same thing, unless otherwise provided. Prohibited by an occupancy chapter. If it's prohibited by occupancy chapter, technically it's not prohibited by an occupancy chapter. However, the North Carolina Building Code, and so what 101 basically says is you can use those UL924s, and it's got five specific requirements that, you know, they either got to come on with motion sensor or loss of power and all that other stuff. There's nothing in 101 that says that you can't technically reduce that as long as it comes on with a motion sensor. But again, if you were going to put a motion sensor and you got a 40 or 20 bed long corridor and the egress lighting in that corridor has to come on by motion sensor, how can you come out of room 1 and make the motion sensor that's down by room 20 come on? So, I mean, that would mean you'd have to have a ton of motion sensors, I guess. I mean, maybe somebody's designed a way to make this work. I don't know. However, the building code, means of egress serving a room or space shall be illuminated at all times the room or space is occupied. Again, we talked about some buzzwords earlier. The means of egress, that exit access corridor, has to be illuminated all the time those rooms are occupied. So if a patient room is occupied, that corridor has always got to be illuminated at a minimum level at the least. So even though 101 technically allows you to use those 924s, this overrides that, and our rules got go by what is more stringent.
5 minutes.
Huh? Yeah, we'll be about 2 minutes right here. Flexible sprinklers, I know we talked about these before. Again, this is a result of an inspector that left his tape measure in his car when he was going to do a sprinkler inspection. I guess I was that guy. So I took an 11-inch piece of paper and folded it in half, made it 5.5, folded it in half, made it 2 3/4, just to show that my diameter here is less than 3 inches. And if you're allowed, if you've got to maintain a minimum radius of 3 inches, that means your diameter's got to be 6 inches. So this is non-compliant. This is non-compliant. And you're not allowed to start your bend of your flex sprinkler line within 2 inches of the nut there. Same thing, and this is showing that we're closer than 2 inches to the nut. There's the requirements right there to be in the PowerPoint when you see it. This is another one. I know we talk about doing some of these virtual inspections and we're going to have you hold up and we're going to tell you to go to look certain locations. If we do that or when we do that, I don't think we'll ever see this because you're not going to go and say, hey, look at this. This sprinkler line just laying on my ceiling. You can't make this stuff up. Dampers. Dampers are still a problem. Here's a damper. We know we don't have enough to get the 1.5-inch angle, so we just kind of bend it. And, well, we sure can't get no screws in there, so don't worry about that. They ain't going to notice that. Here we got a conduit or flex running through where the angle's supposed to be, so we just moved the angle and put the flex there on that one. We do it even better on the next set here. So on this one, instead of using a flex, we decided to stick a sprinkler line in that rough opening. So again, now we've got 2.5 inches plus on the bottom side. We've got 1.5 inch sprinkler. We've got 2 inches on the top side. We know we can only have 2 inches oversized rough opening, so we're just by those 2 points, we know we got too much without pulling off the angles. Approving by documentation. If we say we're going to approve a project by documentation, we must receive the documentation of all requested items. Must be no deficiencies with those items. We require some time to review them. Once we accept them, we'll provide a letter. Yeah, I can say this without incriminating anybody. In June, we told a facility we'd accept documentation for phase one. In January, we got documentation. And so I was like, wow, that took a long time, but this is for the rooms 5 and 6. What about rooms 1, 2, and rooms 3 and 4? Oh, we did 1 and 2 in July. We did 3 and 4 in October, November, and these are 5 and 6. So now I look at the documentation, and they tied onto an oxygen line they weren't allowed to tie onto. They had electrical numbers that were not allowed. They had too much leakage on the electrical. So for 6 months, 7 months, actually was probably 8 months, they were out of compliance. Now they're fixing stuff, but they're fixing stuff from the first phase, not the second and third phase yet. So air balance reports must be completed, must be reviewed and approved by the engineer of record. Please don't send them to us until your engineer has reviewed them. I mean, you know, it's no good for us on inspection to say, did you notice that this is only 70% of design? This is only 60% of design? No, I haven't seen them yet. Well, if you haven't seen them yet and nobody's made any adjustments, you know, I think it's a little premature to have us out there. And again, if you're designing dash rate tables, I put this on my reviews all the time. It looks like you're right on the border. You need 10 air changes of exhaust in that bathroom. You're doing 10.01. If you miss it by 10%, which everybody tries to allow, then you're at 9.32 in the table. We consider most stringent. If you're not meeting the 10 air changes, it's non-compliant. I think we're about. Gen sets, we talk about. I guess I can't make that thing click, but some generators have the output breaker on the generator trips when you hit your e-stop. Again, we still go out there, and when we're testing generators, people don't know how to reset the e-stops properly. In this type setup, it trips that output breaker, and if nobody knows to reset that output breaker, then the inspection goes like this. I say, you sure you got everything reset? And they say, yes. And so then I'll say, okay, I see that that's not reset, but I'm not going to tell you. And we'll go, we'll get 15, 20, it's never done this before, 30 seconds, 45 seconds. I say, you want me to tell you what's wrong? They never reset their output breaker on the generator. Fire alarms must not be disabled, sprinklers not disabled. In the event of a system failure, again, you got to post a fire watch, you got to your local authority notified, and you got to notify us.
You can't see it right now, but have any of you in this room ever noticed how those stained glass cardinals light up about this time of day when you're... It's a perk for the speakers. There's four of them back there, and usually that one on the left lights up really bright. It looks like a red light. It's really a pretty sight to behold in a room like this. So, Dion, have we got time to take a few questions?
Yeah, we got a little bit of time for questions. I know Jeff will address COVID as best he can. Definitely life safety. If anybody's got some questions, raise your hand, and I'll be happy to bring you the mic.
Waivers have been mailed out first, and my understanding is from Mark Payne, the division director, that they will very likely be posted on the website. They wanted to get the secretary, per the governor's directive, wanted to push that stuff out yesterday and today. This is, like we said, Ned, minute by minute, step by step, but yes, I believe the answer to your question is yes. Yes, sir.
He's asking about the 30 feet.
Yeah, if it's a business occupancy, per the definition of business occupancy in 101, per the House bill, if you're...
More than 30.
Yeah.
You don't have more than three patients, all that stuff.
If you mentioned the phrase Lucian healthcare, if your ambulatory healthcare or healthcare has got to be reviewed, the House bill does not exempt you.
Well, ambulatory health care means you've got up to three patients that are incapable of self-preservation.
Correct? Ambulatory health care means four or more rendered incapable.
Okay.
Business up to four, three or fewer can just, be rendered incapable.
Okay. So, and that's the, so if you're just three or under, you don't have to submit to your office.
Per the House bill, per the separation requirements of the House bill, if it's further than 30 feet away from the hospital and owned by the hospital.
Okay. But just to say a private, unassociated clinic that's a bunch of a private endoscopy clinic that's not part of any hospital.
If it's a CON facility and required to be licensed, most of those will still be reviewed if they're operated not under the auspices of the hospital.
Okay.
I know you've probably got a specific project. Bring it to us as a specific project so I can see the particulars of it. Lucian.
Just real quick. So if it's a private, say doctors with endoscopies, it's going to be reviewed by us. But it's not because it's not affiliated with the hospital. It's because endoscopy centers are under the junction of the acute care section, and they are licensed as operating rooms under ambulatory surgery. So it has nothing to do with the hospital, nothing to do with the House bill. It's the fact that they are licensed under ambulatory surgical rules, if that makes sense. If they have one room, one recovery bed, and they have a CON under the ambulatory surgical rules, they are reviewed by us. So it has nothing to do with the affiliation with the hospital. One other thing about one clarification I did want to make about the 13C rules going over to FGI that was effective. Well, it went into effect January 1st. You have up until June 30th to apply. That's a fee has to be paid prior to July 1 before you can maintain the old 13C rules. So if you submit a project to our office, it's designed under the old 13C rules, and your fee is paid July 2nd. You are now under the new FGI rules. Just making sure everybody understands that, okay?
That we did mean to say, she's right. We forgot to put that in the presentation.
Right. And if you need a copy of the old 13C rules, if you will call us, we will send you a PDF copy, because if you go to the website, it has been changed to with the FGI requirements, okay?
Talking about coronavirus, a lot of that stuff is just out of the oven. If we can't answer your particular case specifically today, call us. Give us the chance to discuss with you what the conditions you have.
Backing off the same question the last gentleman had, when you have, let's say, an MOB that's across the street, 750 feet away, but it's infusion bays, and then the provider is using the hospital license and the Medicare number, is it correct that we should still submit that to you, or we shouldn't submit it to you, but we should still meet FGI requirements?
If it's ambulatory health care, submit.
Yeah, and
or health care.
In this case, I'm thinking non-ambulatory.
If it's business and further than 30, if it's purely business, like the slide we showed, you're not required per the House bill to submit it. When you cross, the trick for the owners is, if it looks like you may just have three rendered incapable, a lot of times you really have more than three. You have to think about what those patients are, the nature of them, what the treatments are, whether it's diagnostic or just pure imaging. Sometimes it crosses a line that doesn't appear to be until we really discuss it more thoroughly. Don't forget the example about a CT. You would think you could, outpatient can get up and jump off the table and run out if there was a fire event. Sometimes they can't. They're actually tied to the table to make the scan work. Does anybody have any questions about the virus and the waivers? That will come in the bullet point guidelines that we prepared last week that we would discuss case by case. Yes, that's a very important issue that you just brought up, Keith. If the rules are waived, we can't say, well, this rule still applies if the rule set is waived for that particular service, but the secretary and the director have written the waiver such that construction has to review it case by case and ensure that those patients are still safely taken care of for that use.
But again, it's also up to your facility to do your infection control and risk assessment.
We will ask for
where,
that.
Yeah.
I think Mike's got a question.
Mike.
So in submission for a request to upfit a particular nursing unit with additional or to implement negative pressure rooms just so we could house some patients, you will need to review the temporary means of which we try to
yes.
make that room negative.
Yours is going to be the first request, as far as I know. That means we got to work through it with you to see how we can meet the letter of the waiver.
Help me, help me, help me.
Yeah.
Any more questions, guys? Go ahead. You're loud enough.
Go ahead. I'll follow up on that. So, I mean, we've had a lot of hospitals reach out and ask us about what to do. And one of the things that I have said is that most
of your air handling systems have economizer cycles. So, especially in this weather we have right now, milder weather, you could take your air handler and throw it into an economizer and exhaust all the air. And then I said, go in to the BAS and just manually command the supply fan to back off a little bit, long as we're maintaining the required air changes in the room. And then you could create a temporary negative pressure patient room. Does that have to be reviewed too?
Yes.
Okay.
At the present time, Ned, because these will be the first cases that come in. So rather than, this came up, stuff like this came up in our late night conversations with the director trying to word this. In the beginning, until further tweaking may or may not be required in the waiver, give everything you can to us so we can say, oh, I see what they're trying to make it equivalently safe to. We don't want to resort to doing verbal equivalencies, but they've issued an actual waiver, wipe out portions of the rules, yet the mission statement is law. It comes from the general statutes. It's a law that says you've got to maintain bottom line safety. So they tied it to meeting life safety requirements, which is going to invoke certain other system requirements. That's a good point, and that may be possible. That may be something that Mike will also talk about with us too, but there may be ways to do this, and it depends on the need. It's not like you're going to, I am not aware of any facility that hasn't, their EDs have been overrun with virus patients because we don't have many tests yet. They're not accessible for the public to be tested. That's coming, and that's probably when patients will be identified that need to be hospitalized. They will be treated as inpatients. They must be. Now, we're physical plant people, so
I was waiting to see that answer.
Here
Yes, sir. What do you think they should do? I think the first step, I mean, just as a person in the community, I believe I'd be trying to get to my medical provider, at least by telephone, to get advice on that one.
If you're in here right now and you think you got it, I wouldn't tell anybody until you got safely outside the doors, because you would get mauled.
So I can tell you what hospitals are going through this now, figuring out that patient flow process. And I know at Caremont, the guard shack that's always empty, well, it's full. It's got a guard. It's got a guy in there now. And this is where Emtala comes in, because we're trying to screen them at that point. And if they got these symptoms, and there's a screening questions that we go through, we're going to shovel them off to that temporary structure or something like that before we bring them into the EDs and things like that. So, I mean, hospitals are going through it as we speak right now, figuring out how to do it the right way.
Don is right. Ned's question, in the language of the waiver, it says to present the need in writing, and that information that you just talked about would come to us at least in an email, so we can begin that discourse to say, what if you did this? And then you say, well, here's how we want to do it to provide this net equivalent of negative pressure. Yeah, Don was right.
Here you go.
You have a limited amount of staff resources available. I'm wondering what your plan is for addressing all these concerns that are going to arise continually, and what impact you foresee on review times for inspections and project related.
That's a good question.
I wanted to say that when I started speaking. Dion said we couldn't do sales pitches, but just want everybody to realize we do have 3 engineering and 1 architect position open with the state. So I'll
that's a good question. I take the point. I take your point. There's no prescription for this. We're literally waiting for the avalanche. May not happen. Miracle could happen.
Any other guys? We're about ready to wrap this up. I've been a part of North Carolina for a long time, on and off, and at one time I didn't view you guys as the good guys. I viewed you guys as the bad guy. And you're not the good guy, you're not the bad guy. You're the subject matter experts, authority having jurisdiction on what? On how to protect our patients. That's what it's all about. So I appreciate you taking the time and the effort to come down here and talk to the crowd that's in the stressful times here to listen to what the latest and greatest is coming from the state. So thank you so much. Give these guys a hand. Yeah. I'm sorry I left and Don didn't have any good takeaway pictures. I can say we're going to wrap the conference up. Thank you for being here. I think everybody here definitely got value out of being here for the last 2 days during these times. We did do something different when this conference started, knowing how many healthcare engineers got called back to their hospitals. We opted to get them all recorded. We didn't get them video, but we did get them recorded. So this seminar, this conference will still be available for CEU content because it's audio along with the PowerPoints. Just give us a couple of weeks, get all this stuff uploaded and getting everything working right as far as that goes. I know the board is planning to meet after this, NCHEA board, just to figure out how best NCHEA can support our members during this crisis that's going on right now. We're not really sure what that looks like, but you know, that's what our mission is, to support you members. So I don't know if that's links from ASHI that are tagged onto the website or things like that, but more will be coming out associated with that. Are there any follow-up or any ending questions or comments or anything before we close this thing down, the 2020 Spring Conference? Yes, sir. I've not heard anything about it. Of course, I haven't been on any of the conference calls that my organization's been having either, so they may be talking about it. I don't know. Mike, anything you want to leave with? Cecil, Terry? All right, guys. Thanks a lot.